gate. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
Good morning and welcome to this March 4th, 2009 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here bringing you live conversations with authors, poets, literary agents, and publishers, and today should be a fun one. I'm joined now by Amy Dickinson, who you might know better as Ask Amy, the advice columnist who succeeded Ann Landers, and who is a regular contributor to NPR. Coming up in our second half hour, T.C. Boyle will be here talking about his latest novel that features yet another great American icon, Frank Lloyd Wright. His book is The Women. Amy Dickinson writes the syndicated advice column Ask Amy, which appears in more than 150 newspapers nationwide, including the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, and the Washington Post. Amy hosts a biweekly feature on NPR's Talk of the Nation and serves as a feature panelist on NPR's popular game show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Formerly a columnist for Time magazine, Amy has just released a wonderful memoir, The Mighty Queens of Freeville, published by Hyperion, which we'll talk about this morning, and we'll bring on now. Amy, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Hi. You were on the show a few years back with Barbara talking about the column and journalism, I think.
Oh, yeah, and, that's right.
Yeah, such a fun life. I'm glad I get this chance. This is fun. I'll apologize for my own introduction, but I think it's accurate to say that you succeeded Ann Landers, but there's been some controversy about whether you replaced Ann Landers. And
Well, who could replace Ann Landers?
Exactly.
No one.
Right.
That's the short answer to that question. But the Chicago Tribune, after her death, searched far and wide for somebody to launch a new column, and I was the person they chose.
Yeah, very fun life. I can see a lot of memoirs coming out of that job. I just, I can see compilations of Ask Amy, the best of Ask Amy,
What's funny? When I was first setting out to write a book, something I'd always wanted to do, I was so fortunate to have publishers sort of after me. I mean, how often does that happen? And they were chasing me to write an Ask Amy book. And I came to think of this now doomed project as Amy's big book of advice. And the fact is, I tried that, I feel like I have a day job, and then I have other stories to tell.
Yeah.
And I went back with an idea to tell my own particular story. And, I'm often asked, because I'm an advice columnist, I'm often asked how I know what I know.
Right.
And this is really the answer to that question. This is how I know what I know. I got here the hard way.
I love that. So tell me about the memoir for those who haven't read it yet. Tell us how it goes.
Well, it's really the story of my life raising my daughter Emily as a single parent. My husband up and left when she was a baby, and I've been up and left before, namely by my father, who up and left too. Mm-hmm. And so once Emily grew up so beautifully, I decided to sort of look back and tell our story. And what I always knew was that I didn't get here alone. And she and I, first of all, we raised each other in so many ways, but we also have the benefit of this large, loud, wonderful family of women that we belong to. And so they raised us. And this little village where I grew up and where I'm now sitting in my house on Main Street, the people of this town, I'm one of those fortunate people to be from someplace, you know?
Right.
My family first settled this region over 200 years ago, and so the roots go very, very deep, and it makes a difference. It really does.
Wow. So you know everybody in town, and everybody in town knows all?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my neighbor, Mike, God bless, he just shoveled my walk because, of course, we have a foot of snow here right now.
Right.
And, you know, I looked out, and I saw Mike doing that. He always does that. And Mike and I went to high school together.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And when I go to the post office, you know, I know, you know, all of the postal workers, and they ask how my mom's doing and what's going on. You know, it's a really nice way to live in a community.
That's a piece that's really been lost over the last, I don't know, 25, 30 years, especially, I mean, I'm, you know, here in California where I haven't I've lived in the same house for 12 years and I know none of my neighbors' names. And, you know,
well, you need to get going, make a casserole, you know.
Right.
And the thing is, when you're from someplace, a little village like this, there are 458 people who live here, and so you can't help but know people and to be known. And I say in my book, you know, I grew up feeling like a little celebrity, like everybody does.
Right.
Because people know you, they're watching you, you know, and that's not always a good thing, but for me it was a good thing.
It's interesting because at some point you alluded to the fact that people know you as a celebrity for things that you aren't necessarily famous for. It sounds like they know you from, you know, the cheerleading squad in high school as opposed to the advice columnist.
Well, it's really something for me to go to the little food supermarket here, which is run by Tommy Clark, who I went to the homecoming dance with in 1976. And when I go in there, you know, I'm not Ask Amy. I'm the doofus everyone remembers from, you know, back in the day. And when I see Tommy Clark, who is now bald, you know, middle-aged, I still get that, hi, Tommy. You know, I still get that feeling. It's so funny.
That's funny. I'm chatting with Amy Dickinson, the author of The Mighty Queens of Freeville is her latest memoir. You know, it's interesting because the book had more a feel of a collection of essays to me. Is that how you thought about it as you wrote it, kind of separate essays on your life?
You are a good reader. Yes, I wrote the book as a collection of essays.
Okay.
Each chapter is a standalone essay on a topic. And for some reason, that was the only way I could do it. Yeah. The pieces move through time. So as you read them, you know, the characters are pretty much the same. And we move through time. But for instance, there's a chapter on dating. There's a chapter on livestock, which is my favorite chapter. In fact, when I was pitching this idea to publishers who only wanted the Ask Amy's Big Book of Advice, you know,
right.
I was asked, well, what do you want to write about? And I said, I want to write about livestock. And my agent laughed. She said, I don't even know what you're talking about, but I like it. And because I grew up on a dairy farm, I have been trampled, you know, in my life by all sorts of species of animals, farm-raised, domestic, what have you. And I was dying to write about the relationship between animals and people. It's always intrigued me, and so that was the first piece I wrote.
Nice, nice. And so when you were thinking about the structure of the book and you were breaking it down by headings, were the headings fairly natural to you? You know, did they come together in a obvious, you know, topics of my life sort of way?
You know, they sort of did. I wanted to start out and move through time. So I wanted to start when Emily was a baby. And so I start with when her dad left.
Yeah.
And I write about this very painful breakup and divorce, but I do, through the prism of, you know, in retrospect, and I sort of digress a bit in each chapter, and I talk about Emily's birth and, you know, my feelings about being a young mother, and then to find myself alone, and my choice to take her and bring her to Freeville, where I knew we would be surrounded by these women. Yeah. Who would help us, and right. They did.
Amazingly, they did. I love that.
Yeah.
Did the writing of this reveal anything to you that you didn't otherwise know as you were living through it? Did the process of writing and thinking about it reveal insights that that the act of living through it or reflecting on it otherwise wouldn't have?
Well, I'll tell you what my mother said when she read it. She said she was really surprised. And what surprised her, she said, was how sad parts of it were. Of course, I think of it as sort of a picaresque, you know, funny. It's very funny in parts.
It is, yeah.
Like my life has been, because after all, have to live with myself, and that can be a comedy. But she was surprised at how sad parts of it were. And one of the things I tapped into was my sadness over my losses. Mm. And also my joy at how much I'd recovered, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it really sounds as though, you know, as far as divorces go, you did the divorce in the most sort of, you know, nice, eloquent, you know, classy way you could possibly handle it.
Well, my husband and I didn't do marriage all that well, but we did divorce very, very nicely, and I give him a lot of credit for that. He and I were always very nice to one another, and despite sort of the circumstances, we continued to behave well, and still do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the thing that always strikes me about the memoir is the honesty of it and the inability to hide behind the mask of fiction. And, you know, you just have to let yourself hang out there on the page. And I'm wondering if, did journalism prepare you for this, or did it help you in any way, or did it make
Not
it
a bit. Not a bit. I'll tell you what journalism did do for me, and being a hack, you know, proudly. Journalism prepared me to write on deadline. And I have to say, there's a skill, you know, there is a skill any of us could use. And I wrote this book very quickly. And because I have this other job that's very demanding, I was able to just reach down and draw on some very old-fashioned deadline writing skills.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, deadlines are wonderful things. They're the greatest motivator.
Deadline. There's nothing like a deadline to get you to the typewriter, I'll tell you.
Isn't it true?
Yeah.
I'll remind you again, I'm speaking with Ask Amy. I'm speaking with Amy Dickinson. And will you read to us a little bit from the memoir?
Oh, sure, I'd love to. I happen to have it right here.
Let me tell you, if I had written a book, it would be all over my... Here, it's in my purse. It's in my car.
Yeah, it's everywhere, right. And it's in my head. I'm just going to start out by reading from the first chapter.
Perfect.
This is called Don't Throw Your Ring in the Creek, Surviving the Breakup. One day, I looked out my front window and saw two big moving vans parked outside my house, pointed in opposite directions. Inside the house, two separate crews sifted through our family belongings, according to color-coded Post-it notes. That's when it dawned on me that I really was getting divorced. Granted, the day my husband showed up at our marriage counseling session wheeling a suitcase, having just come in from a trip to Europe with his girlfriend, was a clue that our marriage was in trouble. Other clues were when he told me that he no longer loved me, followed by him saying that he didn't think that he had ever actually loved me. followed further by comments he made about how, after 12 years, he decided that we were too different and that we didn't want the same things in life, and that, by the way, though he liked certain members of my family, he didn't like every member of my family. And how, since my father had left unceremoniously many years before, surely on some level, I expected it to happen again. These are the sorts of conversational atrocities that stick with a person. And the thing about getting divorced is that you tend to spend a lot of time going over every single word that's ever been said pertaining to your relationship. Breaking up and getting together have that in common. When I was first falling in love, I'd sit in the bathtub, slowly soaking, reviewing the events of the night before. What he said, what I said, his crinkly eyes, how I made him laugh. Did he say, I love you, or was it, I'm in love with you? God, which was it? When I was falling in love, decoding the difference between those two statements was a full-time job. When my marriage was ending, I'd sit in the tub quietly sobbing, hoping that I didn't wake the baby and wondering if secondhand smoke would seep under the door and get into her baby lungs. I'd just taken up smoking again because if I was going to get divorced, then I might as well be a smoking, blousy divorcee, a Joan Crawford divorcee. We lived in London at the time, or as my mother used to call it, London, England. Living in a foreign country while you're getting divorced must be worse than living in your home country while you're getting divorced. Living in London, with its alienating plumbing and bow-legged furniture, was the worst of all. I wanted two things when I first learned that my marriage was ending. First, I wanted it not to end. And second, I wanted for others to share a complete and interior knowledge of my heartbreak, followed by demonstrable grief. While there might be tiny streets tucked away somewhere in London where this sort of behavior is both possible and tolerated, they remain like Diagon Alley in the Harry Potter novels, attended by witches and warlocks and mysteriously hidden from the rest of us. Shall I continue?
This is fabulous. You know, first of all, I had to turn off the microphone because I was laughing. And then I kind of forgot, you know, that we're on radio, and I just love listening to you read.
Oh, but, thank you. I love reading.
That is great. That was Amy Dickinson reading from her memoir, The Mighty Queens of Freeville, A Mother, a Daughter, and the Town That Raised Them. we have this conversation a lot when we're talking about memoir, and that is recreating the past from memory onto the page, and how sort of religious you have to be to, you know, the facts that occurred. Is it necessary to render dialogue exactly as it happened, or is it safe to stay in the spirit of the moment? Did you grapple with that at all with this?
I didn't grapple with it. I was always very clear on what I was doing. I was telling my story from my point of view, and I shared everything with Emily because it's her story too. And I read this book in chapters to my mother, who was ill and in the hospital at the time, and it was a great way to share this book with her. But now that it's been published, and now because I live in a small community and people do pop up as little characters,
right,
I have started to hear from people who don't share my version of events. And, you know, I wonder if I should have checked things. Although anyone who's come to me with a concern, it's really such a quibble, you know?
Right.
I mean, really, it's in one case, someone contacted me and said, I thought this was a biography. I thought this was supposed to be all true. And I said, well, your truth and my truth are different. And I'm writing about, in this case, I was writing about an event that happened 35 years ago. And so, yes, it's not a biography. It's a memoir. That means it's a memory.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, of writing a memoir while living in such a small town and what that experience
would
be like.
You know what? Little piece of advice from the advice columnist. Don't do it. Because there's nothing like doing a local reading. I have had local readings. This book has become like, what's that Savannah book? Oh, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Oh, right.
It's become like that, sort of in this region. And so my readings locally are attended by hundreds of people.
Oh.
And there's nothing like doing a reading and being in the moment and looking out and seeing Tommy Clark, you know, who I went to, you know, like a, hi, Tommy. You know, it's a beautiful experience, but it's intimidating too.
I guess that raises the question about whether telling the truth and telling the facts are the same thing. And, you know, if you just write down a set of facts about an experience, that may not get to the truth of the experience, and it certainly
right.
wouldn't get to the truth of the experience for an individual. You know, you really have to go through the process of digesting the facts and coming
right.
up with how that made the truth.
With your truth, right.
right. Yeah.
And, you know, when I was writing this, it was still the age of the edgy memoir. Remember that time?
Oh, yes.
Remember
yes.
that golden time of Augustine Burroughs and James Fry? And, you know, I wrote this little book that's very tender and sweet. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
And I said to the editor after I turned the last chapter in, I said, now, no one gets stabbed here. No one goes to rehab. No one lands in jail, as far as I know. And I said, now who's going to want to read this sweet little book about people where things, you know, pretty much turn out okay?
Right.
I said, who's going to want to read that? She said, everyone.
Right, right.
And sure enough, you know, in the time between the book was finished and the time it was published, our world has changed so much, so rapidly, that I think people are eager to read about what is really a celebration of ordinary life, ordinary people who do wrestle with problems but pretty much work things out. And I feel like that's the power of the story I'm telling.
I really think that's true. And, you know, when you turn on the news right now, it's just, you know, it's doom and gloom everywhere you look. And you can see, you know, unfortunate, sad, tragic things happening to people and see the arc of how it comes out okay on the other side. And I think we are really craving that perspective right now.
Right. And, you know, this is a time when a lot of us, you know, as an advice columnist, I feel like there are two essential questions each of us has to answer. Who am I and what do I want? Last year at this time, the answer might have been, who am I? I'm a wife. I'm a mom. I'm a professional person. I want to succeed. What do I want? I want a $1,200 handbag. You know, when the world changes so rapidly, and a year later, the answers to those questions might be, I'm divorced. I'm right. a mom. I lost my job. You
right.
know, and what do I want? I don't want a $1,200 handbag. I want to put food on the table.
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I think it is true that it'll be interesting to see with all of the shifts that are going on right now how literature shifts along with it and how the memoir shifts along with it. And you pointed out, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, how different memoirs were looking, and I wonder where the future of that goes.
Well, look at the Academy Awards this year. You know, Slumdog Millionaire. Okay, I'm not a slumdog. I'm a dairy princess, I admit. But, you know, I think that people are eager to read stories that are somewhat redemptive, that are about lives that are like their own lives, where stuff happens that you can't control, and you have to stop and work your way out of it, which is what I was forced to do, and over again. And fortunately for me, I knew I had people to turn to help me. And I think a lot of us now are realizing that we are much better when we're in community with other people.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. The other thing that comes up a lot when we're talking about memoir is the revealing of the sacred. And if there is a sense of something sacred, either between you and your daughter, between you and your ex-husband, between you and your women, that needs to stay between you, or if there was ever a time that you grappled with something that shouldn't be put on the page.
Okay, what a great question. And let me pass along a very showy, name-droppy anecdote. When I was first thinking about doing this, I was fortunate enough to have dinner with Nora Ephron, a writer I have always admired. And I took the opportunity, as any ambitious writer should, you know, I took the opportunity to ask her advice. And I said to her I was thinking about writing this true story that involved my life with my daughter, and that there were things about my divorce that I had not told my daughter, but that I was thinking about writing about. And she's somebody who's always been very candid about her own life. And I was thinking of the novel Heartburn, which was so autobiographical. And I asked her how her kids had responded to that over the years. And she told me their response had changed as they got older. But she then said something that made such a difference to me. She said, first of all, you have to tell your daughter the truth about your marriage because it's her story too.
Right.
And she said, and frankly, I can't believe you haven't done that. And I have been protecting my daughter, you know, because I didn't want her to think badly of her dad or me. And she said, so you need to tell her the truth. She's a grown person. She can take it.
Yeah.
But also she said, don't tell her story. She owns her own story. And, of course, Nora Ephron's parents were both writers. And her mother coined the phrase, it's all material. And she described her parents as thieves. She said, you know, they were, you know, anything was fodder for them.
Yeah.
And she said, I decided I wouldn't do that to my kids, that if they wanted to tell their stories, they could. And it just, the very next day, I sat down with my daughter and I talked to her about stuff that I'd never talked to her about. I asked her permission to write this book, which I very much needed to get. And I got it. And I assured her that I would not tell her story, but that I would tell our story. And I shared this book with her as I was writing it, and I gave her opportunities to weigh in, and she did.
I love it. I love it. Any last-minute advice from the advice columnist?
I'll repeat what my mother always says to me when I'm in a jam. Well, keep your powder dry, you know? And just keep writing, you know? All the writers out there, just keep... I've taught writing classes over the years, and I just think people just need to sit down and write.
Exactly true. Exactly true. Amy, this was such a huge pleasure.
Oh, same for me.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
That was Amy Dickinson, her memoir, The Mighty Queens of Freeville, which you can visit at themightyqueensoffreeville.com for more information about the book and more information about Amy. What a great treat. We're going to take a break, but please stay with me. T.C. Boyle will be here when we come back. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, and I'll be right back.
Come back, baby. Love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Planetary Radio is public radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit the iTunes public radio page or Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm here now with T.C. Boyle, the author of 20 books of fiction, including most recently After the Plague, Drop City, The Inner Circle, Tooth and Claw, The Human Fly, Talk Talk, and most recently, and the subject of our discussion this morning, The Women, a look into the life of renowned architect Frank Lloyd Wright and the women who loved him. T.C. Boyle received his PhD degree in 19th century British literature from the University of Iowa in 1977, his MFA from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop in 74, and his BA in English and History from SUNY Potsdam in 1968. He's been a member of the English department at USC since 1978. His work has been translated into more than two dozen foreign languages. His stories have appeared in most of the major American magazines, including The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, The Atlantic Monthly, Playboy, Paris Review. He's been the recipient of a number of literary awards. He currently lives in near Santa Barbara in the George C. Stewart House, the first Frank Lloyd Wright's California Designs, which celebrates its centennial this year. T.C. Boyle, welcome.
Hi, Marie, and thanks for that wonderful introduction. Well, it makes me tired just hearing about all that stuff. How did I manage it?
I could have gone on and on.
Writing the next book.
I know. You must be like 150 years old to have accomplished all of this. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I know, and I'm only 19.
It's unbelievable. I know you've been on the show a couple of times before with Barbara, but this is my first bite at the apple, so what a treat for me.
My pleasure.
Yeah, there's about 25 hours worth of conversation that we have to boil down to 25 minutes, so I'll jump into it. But for those of the listeners out there who aren't familiar with the book yet, tell us a little bit about The Women.
Well, this is a book about Frank Lloyd Wright and the women in his life, and it's told primarily from the points of view of the four principal women in his life. That is, his first wife, Kitty, his second wife, Miriam, his mistress, Mema, who was murdered, and finally his wife, Olga Ivanovna, with whom he lived for the rest of his life.
And you've talked before about your draw to kind of egomaniacal characters. You've, you know, tackled John Harvey Kellogg and Alfred Kinsey, Frank Lloyd Wright this time. I love how you've described Kinsey in the past, the inventor of sex. do you feel like you need to feel a certain kinship or some kind of connection to the characters you choose to spend time with?
No, not necessarily. But, yeah. Of course, these three characters that you mentioned all fall under the rubric of great egomaniacs of the 20th century. In fact, my editor, Paul Slovak, said, hey, we'll do a box set of the great egomaniacs. Obviously, there's something in this narcissistic personality that attracts me because, of course, many novelists are exactly like this. And maybe I write such things as a kind of cautionary tale to myself to remember that while I have readers, they are not my followers. I am not a guru. I am not advancing anything except just art.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm wondering in these historic fiction novels where the lives are already known and the details are already in place, talk about the process of excavating characters, and a matter of taking the known information and facts and from those facts drawing out and discovering who these people were and what drove them on, or is it a matter of really interiorly inhabiting these people in a different way?
Both. Absolutely. I really love these odd bits of history that people aren't aware of. In the case of John Harvey Kellogg, Kinsey, and now Wright, their lives were so odd and so bizarre and full of incident that really even the most crazed novelist in his garret couldn't invent all of this stuff. So I love to present it to you whole because I love what the history is itself. That said, I then have to dramatize it and, as you suggest, inhabit the characters. You know, history and biography give us facts. Of course, even the facts are fudged a bit, depending on who is telling this history or this biography. And yet, what fiction can do is to dramatize it. How did they feel? Why did they do what they did? What might they have said at a given moment in their lives?
Right.
That's what I'm having fun with.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting.
And also, one further thing, Marie. And also, it's a kind of synthesis of the material. Anyone could write a novel about one of these figures, and other people have in the past. Or with the example of Kinsey, for instance, there was Bill Condon's movie, Kinsey, that came out around the same time as my book. It's a way, how does the artist approach it? How does the artist frame and synthesize the material? That's another thing that really interests me.
It's so funny you say that because the next question on the tip of my tongue is how interesting it is for me to consider how many ways and doors there are into a person, all the ways of accessing a legendary character like this. So I love the concept of getting into the man through getting into the women around him. And did you struggle with how to access Frank Lloyd Wright, or was it a very obvious?
Yeah.
Obviously, his life was. Predisposed to the women around him, but
well, sure. I didn't want to do a conventional telling. There are something like 1,000 books in print about Frank Lloyd Wright and his work. He remains peripheral to this story. Actually, we do enter his point of view occasionally, mm-hmm. but basically, it's told from the points of view of his women in a third-person close narration. But also, there's an overarching narrator here, an invented character named Tadashi Sato, who was an apprentice of Frank Lloyd Wright's in the 30s at Taliesin. And so he is the one who has told this story, not me, and he's told it in the form of a memoir, which he has then delivered to his grandson-in-law, the Irish-American writer Seamus O'Flaherty, and Seamus O'Flaherty has novelized it. So I'm having a lot of Nabokovian fun here with layers of meaning and the meaning of history as it's received, and who tells it, and how do you interpret it? I mean, it sounds elaborate, but it seemed like a very natural thing when I was doing it, and I think readers will have a lot of fun with it.
It seemed like a very natural thing when I was reading it, and I was wondering if that was a device you've incorporated in the past, along with all of the wonderful footnotes that Tadashi uses. It's a great way to get at a lot of angles all at once, I think.
Yeah, I like your interpretation. Yes, it allows me to do a lot of things. Tadashi's footnotes sometimes are just factual, so that if you know nothing about Frank Lloyd Wright and his life, you will learn all about his life and his work and what he did in building various houses and so on. But it also allows me to make little jokes at the expense of Frank Lloyd Wright and of Tadashi, too, because he is, in essence, looking over this manuscript as delivered to him by his grandson-in-law, and he is responding to it, and that's how the footnotes come out. He is saying, well, is that really true, or this is how I feel at this moment? And his relationship to the master changes, I think, as he goes through this text.
Yeah, that's right. I want to remind our listeners that I'm chatting with T.C. Boyle this morning. His latest novel is The Women. Did you struggle with the rules about what the narrator knows and has access to? And because it often shifts into the points of view of the women as well, is it?
Yeah, I love your use of the verb struggle. Yes, of course. Everyone out there, I'm sure, is aware that to create something like this is a tremendous struggle, and it's a day-to-day operation. Everything I do moves forward very slowly, line by line, day by day. I don't leap ahead. I don't write the end scene first. It all happens organically, just as Frank Lloyd Wright's work is organic. And yes, of course, it's a struggle to make these discoveries. But when you do make them, and it does come together, and the structure suggests itself to you, you feel pretty enriched.
I was wondering if you found a parallel between the writing of this and the architecture, and any sort of parallels with the work he did and the work you did, and building the vision to build something massive, either imaginarily massive or, you know, in the world massive as he did. Do you think there's any parallel in the process?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the informing metaphor of the whole project to begin with. You know, the other two figures we talked about were scientists. Here I'm writing about an artist. And while I don't really get into his method of creation much, I mean, I tell some of the familiar stories about it, like how he would shake these designs out of his sleeve when Mr. Kaufman, who had hired him to make Falling Water, was driving from Milwaukee 18 months after the plans were supposed to have been done, and he just shook them out of his sleeve and drew those plans by the time Mr. Kaufman had arrived from Milwaukee at Taliesin. But yeah, there's an obvious comparison between creating a novel and building a house. They are similar. Frank Lloyd Wright would begin with a vision. He saw something, and he would draw it as a finished house, as a picture in colored pencil. And so when a novelist begins to write, he sees something, and he begins to translate that into words, just as then the architect translates his vision into plans and into, the actual materials of building the structure.
Yeah, that's the beauty of being an architect, is that you have the physical plans, and as a novelist, you probably don't.
We don't.
I don't know if you, yeah.
We don't have, I don't anyway, I work intuitively. I don't have the plan, except as it is somewhere in my unconscious mind and revealing itself each day. But, of course, there is an overarching structure to every work, and that structure is as important to whether or not this thing will hold up as the plans that an architect has to work with so that his structure will hold up and not collapse under its own weight.
Yeah. You know what I'm so impressed with in this is how convincingly you navigate the women. I sure as heck don't understand women. I don't understand myself. So I'm delighted when men can do this so well. And I know Miriam captivated you. She was third wife in there,
She was the third woman and the second wife, yes, because he was never able to marry Mama. Kitty wouldn't grant a divorce. But thank you very much for the compliment. I take it as a challenge to, as a novelist, to try to inhabit anybody of any race, ethnicity, gender. In fact, my proudest moment along these lines was in a story called Big Game, in which, for a couple of paragraphs, I inhabited the mind of Bessie B., the old circus elephant, who was very tired of having that goad stuck into her.
Yeah, you've said many times that that you've thrown out the adage of write what you do know for write what you don't know so that you can learn about it. And it's just unbelievable how well you do it.
Well, thanks. Yes, that's my credo. I'm not really bound by any conventions. I can write a story about anything I like in any mode. And often I write pieces in order to discover something. For instance, I've lived in this house for 16 years and wanted to know more about the architect, to become something of an expert. That was one of the initial promptings for this project. And I think that happened, and I'm very pleased about it, and now I have a novel as a result. At the same time, I've been driving up the Coast Highway for 16 years looking at the Channel Islands, wondering what goes on out there, and the novel that I'm writing now, When the Killing's Done, has to do with the ecological restoration on Santa Cruz Island, so now I know, and I've been out there, and I've been out there with the biologists and seen the first two bald eagles that have been born there since 1940, helped with the trapping of the dwarf foxes and so on. So I'm really quite lucky in that anything that stimulates me can be a story.
Yeah. I also love the vacillation between the historical fiction versus the contemporary fiction. You're often going back and forth of, you know, the last book was on identity theft, and then you go back in time. And it does kind of seem like there's a ping-pong effect in your thinking, where you go back, and then you come forward, and then you go back. Is that true, or is that...
I like that characterization, absolutely. I found some kind of rhythm early on where I would write a longer historical narrative, half a book of stories, a shorter usually shorter, contemporary narrative, the other half a book of stories, and on and on. And that rhythm has been very good to me. It keeps me from running dry and keeps me stimulated. So I hope that we will continue on into the future.
Yeah.
You may know I have a book of stories ready for next year at this time called Wild Child, and it's 14 new stories anchored by the novella Wild Child, which, as readers of my work will know, wasn't written by me, but in fact was written by Dana Halter, the deaf heroine of Talk Talk, the novel you were just referring to.
Wonderful. Yeah, I can't wait for that. Tell me about getting stuck in your work. Are there points where you get stuck going down blind alleys with characters or storylines?
That never happens. No, that doesn't happen, because I think maybe early on when I first started to write stories, I would write entire stories that weren't very good and throw them away. Now I think I'm more attuned to knowing what's going to work and what's not, so that doesn't really happen. You are stuck, of course, in every story and every novel in the middle, because that's when the burst of joy of starting is starting to wear off, and you realize that you have to now determine on some unconscious level what this is about, what its themes are, what it means, why you're doing it, and where it's going, even plot-wise. So, of course, there are difficult periods. We mentioned the term struggle earlier on, when you really feel that you're not going to be able to complete it, that you're at a dead end, that nothing will avail. But I stick with only one project at a time and try to fight through that, and so far I've been able to.
Yeah. I'm chatting with T.C. Boyle, his latest novel, The Women, the 20 works of fiction he has out there. The other thing that really is stunning to me about your work consistently, apart from the sheer amount of it and how prolific you manage to be, is the unbelievable prose, the sentence structure. The turns of phrase consistently leave me just, you know, staring at the page and here's one now.
Oh, shucks. Graham, just doing what comes natural. The language, of course, is the most important part of any literary work, at least to my mind. I always work with music playing. The rhythm is very important to me. You know that I love to go out and perform my work to the public. I read each day to my poor, long-suffering wife just to hear how it sounds aloud, because the rhythm and beauty of the language is the essential part of the artistry of making something beautiful. I don't really care for genre writing, for the most part, because it sacrifices that sort of thing to just the plot itself. And I think, for my money, I like art, literary art, that is fully integrated, so that you have beautiful language and startling metaphors that seem natural, as well as a powerful story and a thematic level that makes you think and provokes you.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you read your work aloud, and if you're influenced by poetry or read a lot of poetry. There's wonderful alliteration. There's wonderful juxtaposition of words that the rhythm is just right. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. The writers whom I most admire seem to have a natural rhythm. It's everybody's is somewhat different, but I don't know if everybody, even editors, are aware of how it has to sound. You know, you can't remove a given syllable from a sentence without it sounding flat-footed, and so you have to substitute another one. Again, it just seems natural to me. I don't know exactly how to explain it, except that it is very musical and rhythmic, and it has to be. And again, that's why I never have written anything without music playing in the background.
Interesting. Is this? I assume this is something that is cultivated over the 20 plus years, or 20 plus books that you've written. That, or maybe it does just fall out of you like this.
I'm not sure. I work 7 days a week. This is my life, and so I'm always looking for stories. In fact, I really have no way of assessing the world in general unless I make stories out of it. It's just the way that that I work. I'm not exactly sure why. So I hope that experience serves me. But again, right from the beginning, I was working in this mode, and I think I was developing a recognizable style, and I think a large part of it has to do with not only what I'm selecting to talk about and what my themes are, but also what you said earlier, the use of language and the attempt to make it beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. You've done that. You've done that. It's interesting to me that the things that you've worked on, you alluded to this earlier with your Kinsey project, and the world being kind of interested in what you're interested in at the time, and the Loving Frank book coming out last year. Do you think somebody's looking down your shoulder as you're working and getting interested in the same things you're interested in, or is it just...
Well, you're referring to Nancy Horan's book, yeah. The Loving Frank, which came out last year. After I'd already delivered my book, we mm-hmm. held mine back because of the election. Still, it was two writers working on the same material. Her book deals with the death of Mamo, which is a very dramatic and wonderful thing. My approach was to look at the entire career and the other women as well. But again, when you're dealing with an historical figure, that you run the risk of having other people working on the same thing at the same time. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing.
No.
I think the book can reflect off of one another. Bill Condon's movie Kinsey came out 2 months after The Inner Circle, as I mentioned earlier, and we went on stage at the Hammer Museum together and talked about two artists approaching the same material. I would be fascinated to, as a project, see perhaps 10 novelists write about the same historical incident.
Yeah.
Because they would be so incredibly various.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, that would be fascinating. Yeah, there's no way to approach even, you know, a sentence in the same way and come out with the same result in the end, I think. So it's interesting.
Same valence or vision of how you tell the story. And that's the interesting thing, too. We talked earlier about taking on an historical account or a biographical account, and how do you fictionalize it? Well, there's a way into every story. Everybody listening right now is telling stories every day, what happened to them at the supermarket, you know, what their boss said yesterday or their daughter. And when you tell that story to your friend, you always find a point of entry. Where do you start this story? How do you begin it? How do you come into it? And from what point of view are you going to tell it?
And how, for all of these, which must involve a ton of research, is that done up front and that informs the way you approach it, or is that done while you're doing it?
Most of the research is done up front, and as you say, that gives me a sense of what it will be. And I often liken it to the dreaded term paper. In some way, I'm still doing term papers. You absorb a lot of material, you take notes, you don't know exactly what you will use and what you won't. The project begins, and sometimes you refer back to those notes, but basically you have made some sort of synthesis of your own, and you're moving forward. Now, of course, since I never know what it will be, sometimes I have to go in different directions, and then I can access new material as need be. But, yeah, the initial period of research, which might last on a book like this one, perhaps 3 months or so, that's what begins to suggest to me how the story might be told.
Yeah. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to have you read to us, but we ran out of time on that. And hearing you read is a huge treat. So I encourage people to go onto the web. There's a lot of occasions where you're reading online, and it's listening to your voice inside your own work is just a huge treat. So,
well, thanks so much, Maria. I love to do it, and I did do the last three books for Books on Tape. I did not have an opportunity to do this one, but I hope to do the next two.
Yeah, you really should. It does such a service to the work to hear it read out loud. This is my first, your book is the first that I've read on my new Kindle, and... Mm-hmm. You should not do the text-to-speech on the Kindle with your works. It doesn't work out so well. Any last-minute words of advice?
Advice
for
writers? Yeah, well,
for
you know, find a good pizza shop and stick close by. Advice for writers, you know, I always make jokes about it. My advice to young writers is come from a very wealthy family. But, in fact... you have to have faith in what you're doing, and you have to pursue it against all the slings and arrows of everybody else, because, of course, no one really wants you to succeed. And you have to persist, especially if you believe in your work. I don't make any promises. You know, some of us have gotten very, very lucky and have a readership. I'm very thankful for that. But whether I did or not, I would do the same thing every day of my life.
Yeah, and in your case, I wouldn't put it in terms of luck. I would put it in
no,
terms
it is
of
luck. Chantal. Luck is a huge part of making it as an artist. I mean, you know, having a gift and pursuing it fanatically to the exclusion of all else, but still that doesn't guarantee success. I mean, there is a lot of luck involved as to who your publishers and editors and agents and friends and family are and how they support you and what your readership is and how they come to you. You know, there are, just the fact that we're sitting here alive talking is a matter of astonishing luck, you know?
That's true. That's a good point. This was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Marie.
Thank you. That was T.C. Boyle, his latest book, The Women, available in bookstores and online now. I took a quote of T.C. Boyle's for the ending of our show this morning. Writing is a habit, an addiction, as powerful and overmastering as urge to put a bottle to your lips or a spike in your arm. Call it the impulse to make something out of nothing. Call it an obsessive compulsive disorder. Call it Ligoria. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. And have a great day. I just don't wanna be free, no.